Abruptly, the passage ended, and he ran his hand over rough rock. His lungs were beginning to pump in earnest, and there was a singing in his ears. His vision was clouded with swirling sediment and the beginnings of dizzy vertigo, but he forced himself to stay on and examine the end of the tunnel from side to side and top to bottom, running his free hand over it. Quickly he realized that he was feeling a wall of limestone masonry, packed carefully into place to block off the tunnel, and his spirits plunged. The old witch doctors had once again sealed Lobengula's tomb, and in the brief seconds he had left, he realized that they had made a thorough job of it. His searching fingers touched something with a smooth metallic feel lying at the foot of the wall. He took it up and turned away from the wall, shoving himself down the passage, with panic and the need for air rising in him. He reached the main gallery again, still carrying the metallic object in one hand. High above him, the lantern glowed, and he swam upwards, with his senses beginning to flutter like a candle flame in the wind. Darkness and stars of light played before his eyes as his brain starved, and he felt the first deadly lethargy turning his hands and his foot to lead. With a jerk, the rope around his waist came tight, and he felt himself being drawn swiftly upwards. 3 minutes, and Tungata was pulling him out. The lantern light spun dizzily overhead as he windmilled on the end of the rope, and he could not prevent himself. He tried to breathe, and freezing water shot down his throat and went into his lungs, stinging like the cut of a razor. He exploded out through the surface, and Tungata was waist-deep, hauling double-handed on the lifeline. The instant he broke through, Tungata seized him, a thick, muscled arm around his chest, and he dragged Craig to the edge. The two girls were ready to grab his wrists and help him up onto the slab. Craig collapsed on his side, doubled up like a fetus, coughing and heaving the water from his lungs and shaking violently with cold. Sally Ann rolled him onto his stomach and bore down on his back with both hands. Water and vomit shot up his throat, but his breathing gradually eased, and at last he sat up, wiping his mouth. Sally Ann had stripped off her own shirt and was chafing him vigorously with it. In the lantern light, his body was dappled blue with cold, and he was still shivering uncontrollably. "How do you feel?" Sarah asked. "Bloody marvellous," he gasped. "Nothing like a bracing dip."
"He's all right," Tungata assured them. "As soon as he starts snarling, he's all right."
Craig cupped his hands over the chimney of the lantern for warmth, and gradually his shivering eased. Sarah leaned across to Tungata, and with a wicked smile, directed at Craig's naked lower body, whispered something.
"Right on," Tungata chuckled, imitating a black American accent. "And what's more, these honkies ain't got no rhythm, neither."
Craig reached quickly for his underpants, and Sally Ann rushed loyally to his defense.
"You're not seeing him at his best. The water is freezing."
Craig's hands were stained red-brown with rust. They marked his underpants, and he remembered the metal object he had found at the wall of the tomb. It lay where he had dropped it at the edge of the slab.
"Part of a trek chain," he said as he picked it up. "From an ox wagon."
Vuzamanzi had been squatting silently on one side at the edge of the lantern light. Now he spoke.
"That chain was from the king's wagon. My grandfather used it to lower the king's body down the shaft."
"So you have found the king's grave?" Tungata asked. This mundane little scrap of metal was for all of them the proof that changed fantasy to factual reality.
"I think so," Craig began strapping on his leg. "But we'll never know for certain."
They all watched his face and waited. Craig suffered another paroxysm of coughing. Then his breathing settled and he went on.
"There's a passage, just as Vuzamanzi described. It's about another 15 feet below that pinnacle, and it goes off to the left, a round opening with a shaft that rises sharply. About 20 feet from the entrance, the shaft has been blocked with masonry, big blocks and lumps of limestone packed closely together. There's no way of telling how thick the wall is, but one thing's certain. It's going to take a lot of work to get through it. I had about 20 seconds endurance at the face, not long enough to prize out even a single block. Without diving apparatus, nobody's going to get past that seal."
Sally Ann was shrugging on her damp shirt,
over her white bra. But she stopped and stared at him challengingly. "We can't just give up, Craig, darling. We can't just walk away and never know. It would eat me up not knowing. A mystery like that? I'd never be happy. Never again as long as I lived."
"I'm open to suggestions," Craig agreed sarcastically. "Anybody got a scuba tucked in their back pocket? How about paying Vuzumanzi a goat, and he can make the water jump aside, shades of Moses and the Red Sea?"
"Don't be flippant," said Sally Ann.
"Come on, somebody, be intelligent and inventive. What, no takers? Okay, then let's go back to where there's a fire and a little sunlight."
Craig dropped the rusted piece of chain back into the pool.
"Sleep well, Lobengula. The one who drives like the wind. Keep your firestones beside you. And Shalagashli, stay in peace."
The climb back up through the maze of passages and interleading caverns was a dismal and silent procession, although Craig checked and remarked each turn and juncture as he passed it. When they reached the main cavern again, it took only a few minutes to blow the embers of the hearth to flames and boil a canteen of water. The strong, over-sweetened tea warmed away the last of Craig's chills and heartened them all.
"I must return to the village," Vuzumanzi told them. "If the Shona soldiers come and do not find me, they will become suspicious. They will begin to bully and torture my woman. I must be there to protect them, for even the Shona fear my magic."
He gathered up his pouch and cloak and his ornately carved staff.
"You must remain in the cavern at all times. To leave it is to risk discovery by the soldiers. You have water and food and firewood and blankets and paraffin for the lanterns. There is no need for you to go out. My women will come to you the day after tomorrow with food and news of the Shona."
He went to kneel before Tongata.
"Stay in peace, great prince of Kumalo. My heart tells me that you are the leopard cub of the prophecy, and that you will find a way to free the spirit of Lobengula."
"Perhaps I will return here one day with the special machines that are necessary to reach the king's resting place."
"Perhaps," Vuzumanzi agreed. "I will make sacrifice and consult the spirits. They might condescend to show me the way."
At the entrance of the cave, he paused and saluted them.
"When it is safe, I shall return. Stay in peace, my children."
And then he was gone.
"Something tells me it's going to be a long, hard time," said Craig, "and not the most attractive place to pass it."
They were all active and restlessly intelligent people, and the confinement began to irk almost immediately. Tacitly, they divided the cavern, a communal area around the hearth and a private area at either end for each couple. The seepage of water down the rock face, when collected in a clay pot, was sufficient for all their needs, including ablutions, and there was a vertical pothole shaft in one of the passages which served as a natural latrine. But there was nothing to read, and, a lack that Craig felt keenly, no writing material. To alleviate the boredom, Sarah began teaching Sally Ann Cinderbelly, and her progress was so rapid that she could soon follow ordinary conversation and respond to it fairly fluently. Tongata recovered rapidly during those days of enforced inactivity. His gaunt frame filled out, the scabs on his face and body healed rapidly, and he regained his vitality. It was often Tongata who led the long, rambling discussions at the fireside, and that irrepressible sense of humour that Craig remembered so well from the old days began to break through the sombre moods that had at first overwhelmed him. When Sally Ann made a disparaging remark about the neighbouring South African state and its apartheid policies, Tongata contradicted her with mock severity.
"No, no, Pendula."
Tongata had given her the Matabele name of the one who always answers back.
"No, Pendula.
Rather than condemning them, we black Africans should give thanks for them every time we pray, for they can bring 100 tribes together with a single rallying cry. It is only necessary for one of us to stand up and shout, 'Racist apartheid Boers,' and all the others stop beating each other over the head, and for a moment we become a band of brothers."
Sally Ann clapped her hands.
I'd love to hear you make that speech at the next meeting of the Organization for African Unity."
Tungata chuckled at her. They were becoming good friends.
"Another thing we have to be grateful for," he went on.
"Tell me more," she incited him.
"Those tribes down there are some of the fightingest niggers in Africa,"
Tungata obeyed.
"Zulus and Xhosas and Tswanas. We have got our hands full with the Shona.
Imagine if that lot were turned loose on us also.
No, from now on my motto is going to be kiss an Afrikaner every day."
"Don't encourage him," Sarah pleaded with Sally Ann.
"One day he is going to talk like this in front of people who will take him seriously."
At other times, Tungata relapsed back into those intense and dark moods.
"It is like Northern Ireland or Palestine, only 100 times bigger and more complex. This conflict between ourselves and the Shona is a microcosm of the entire problem of Africa."
"Do you see a solution?" Sally Ann demanded.
"Only a radical and difficult one," he told her. "You see, the European powers in their 19th century scramble for Africa divided the continent up amongst themselves with no thought for tribal boundaries. And it is an entrenched article of the Organization for African Unity that these boundaries are sacrosanct. One possible solution would be to overturn this article and repartition the continent along tribal boundaries. But after the terrible experience of partitioning India and Pakistan, no rational person would support that view. The only other solution seems to me to be a form of federal government based loosely on the American system, with the state divided into tribal provinces possessing autonomy in their own affairs."
Their talk ranged across time, and for the entertainment and instruction of the two girls, both Craig and Tungata related the history of this land between the Limpopo and Zambezi rivers, with each of them concentrating on the role played by their own nations and families in its discovery and occupation, and the strife that had torn it. Twice on successive days, their talk at the hearth was interrupted by sounds from the world outside the cavern. The unmistakable, whistling, clattering roar of a helicopter rotor hammering through the air in coarse pitch setting, and they fell silent and looked up at the roof of stone above them until the sound faded. Then the talk would turn to their chances of escape from the forces that pursued and hunted them so relentlessly. Every second day the women came from Vuzamanzi's village, travelling in the darkness of pre-dawn to elude the eyes in the sky above them. They brought food and news. The 3rd Brigade troopers had come to the village, surrounding it first and then storming it and ransacking the huts. They had cuffed one of the young girls, and they had shouted threats and badgered the old man. But Vuzamanzi had faced them down with dignity, and in the end his formidable reputation for magic had protected them. The soldiers had left without stealing much of value, without burning a single hut or killing more than a few chickens. But they had promised to return. However, a massive manhunt was still in progress over the entire area. On foot and from the helicopters, the Shona scoured the forest and hills during the hours of daylight, and hundreds of the escapees from the camp had already been recaptured. The girls had seen them being transported in heavy trucks, naked and chained together. As far as Vuzamanzi knew, the Shona had not yet discovered the wrecked Cessna, but it was still extremely dangerous, and Vuzamanzi had ordered the girls to impress upon them they must remain in the cavern. He would come to them in person when he judged it safe to do so. This news depressed them all, and it took all Craig's best storytelling and clowning to lighten the mood in the cavern. He turned their attention back to their perennially favourite topic, the tomb of Lobengula and the vast fortune they liked to believe it contained. They had already discussed in detail the equipment that would be needed to enable a team of divers to open the tomb and reach the burial area. And now Sally Ann asked Tungata, "Tell us, Sam, if there were a treasure, and if you could reach it, and if it were as rich as we hope, how would you use it?"
"I think it would have to be treated as belonging to the Matabele people. It would have to be placed in trust and used for their benefit, firstly to procure for them a better political dispensation. To be pragmatic, a negotiator with that sort of financial clout behind him would find it easier to get the attention of the British Foreign Office and the American State Department. He could prevail upon them to intervene. The government in Harare would have to take them seriously,
options which are at present closed to us would become accessible. After that, it would finance all sorts of social programs. Education, health, the forwarding of women's rights, Sarah said, for the moment her timidity put aside.
You would use it to make land purchases to add to the existing tribal trust lands, Craig added. Financial assistance to the peasant farmers, aid for tractors and machinery, bloodstock improvement programs.
Craig, Sally Ann laid her hand on his good leg, isn't there any way at all to reach the burial chamber? Couldn't you try another dive?
My precious girl, for the 100th time, let me explain that I could probably move a single rock with each dive, and 20 dives would kill me.
Oh, God, it's so frustrating!
Sally Ann jumped up and began pacing up and down between them.
I feel so helpless. If we don't do something, I'm going to go mad. I feel as though I'm suffocating. I need a good breath of oxygen. Can't we just go outside for a few minutes?
And then immediately she answered herself. Well, that just isn't on, I know. Forgive me, I'm being silly. She looked at her wristwatch. My God, I've lost all track of time. Do you realize it's after midnight already? Craig and Sally Ann lay on their mattress of cut grass and tanned skins, holding each other close and whispering with their lips touching each other's ears so as not to disturb the other pair at the end of the cavern. I'm ashamed of my part in having him imprisoned. He's such a marvellous man, darling. Sometimes I feel so humble when I listen to him. He might just make it to greatness. Coming back here to free him may be the most important thing that you and I have ever done in our lives.
If we get away with it, Craig qualified.
There must be some justice in this naughty world.
It's a nice thought.
Kiss me good night, Craig. Craig loved to listen to her sleeping, the gentle sound of her breathing, and to feel the total relaxation of her body against his, with only the occasional little snuggling movement in his arms. But tonight he could not follow her into sleep. Something was snagged in his subconscious like a burr in his sock, and the longer he lay, the fiercer became its irritation. Something somebody had said that evening, he figured it that far, but every time it started to rise to the surface of his mind, he tried too hard and it sank away again. At last he resorted to the old trick of emptying his mind, imagining a waste paper basket, and as each unbidden thought came, he tore it in half, crumpled it, and dropped it into the imaginary basket.
Christ! He said loudly,
and sat bolt upright. Sally Ann was jolted awake and came up beside him, pushing the hair out of her eyes and mumbling drowsily.
What is it?
Tungata called across the cavern.
Oxygen! Cried Craig.
Sally Ann had said, I am suffocating. I need a good breath of oxygen.
I don't understand, Sally Ann mumbled, still more asleep than awake. Darling, wake up. Come on!
He shook her gently.
Oxygen! The Cessna is equipped for high-altitude flight, isn't it? Oh, sweet heavens!
She stared at him.
Why didn't we think of it before?
Life jackets. Do you have them?
Yes. When I was doing the flamingo survey over Lake Tanganyika, I had to have them installed. They are under the seat cushions.
And the oxygen system? Is it a recycling circuit?
Yes.
Pufo!
Tungata had lit the lantern and carried it across to them with Sarah naked and unsteady on her feet, trailing behind him like a sleepy puppy.
Tell us, Pufo, what is happening?
Sam, you beauty, Craig grinned at him as he reached for his pants. You and I are going for a little walk.
Now?
Now, while it's still dark.